She is an absolute powerhouse of a conservationist. She is incredibly humble, incredibly modest. She never blows her own trumpet at all, and yet she has so much to shout about. She has single-handedly prevented and exposed rat persecution and horrible bird crime throughout the UK for decades, and she's dedicated her life and put her own life at risk many times for nature. And I think she's just super cool. And there's not many women working in that space, and she just is such a torchbearer.
Hello and welcome to 2024, and welcome back to Trees a Crowd. My name is David Oakes, and this is a podcast for those of you who, like me, think the natural world is incredible. Regular listeners to the show may recognise the voice you just heard as that of award-winning science communicator Sophie Bavell speaking on this podcast from a live event in 2022, and she was speaking about her natural history hero, who just so happens to be today's guest. From Madagascar to Mexico, via Mauritius and the Scottish Highlands, there are few places this conservationist and tireless campaigner hasn't worked to conserve our planet's birds of prey and their habitats. As the founder of the now over a decade-running Raptor Persecution blog, and one of the three founding members of the government-challenging charity Wild Justice, she is one of the most powerful voices speaking out against wildlife crime in our country today. But not wanting to attract attention from those keen to perpetuate animal cruelty, she also tries to keep a low profile. As such, to record this interview, last September I headed out to a mysterious grid reference in the middle of the Peak District on a particularly blustery day, in the hope of not only sighting some short-eared owls, but also one of the bravest voices in British conservation. So, without further ado, this is Trees a Crowd, and this is Dr. Ruth Tingay.
In the depth of the forest and all over, the pride of the greenwood there, o'er his branches the ivy her mantle threw, when the forest boughs were bare. Oh, the oak and the ivy, oh, the oak and the ivy, oh.
Okay, Ruth, who are you? What do you do?
At the moment, I'm a campaigner, I guess, for wildlife conservation. My background is in raptor ecology and conservation, and I still get off looking at raptors.
Which leads us on to what we're looking for today.
We're looking for short-eared owls, okay. Hopefully, although it's kind of hit and miss up here, but if they do come, you tend to get some pretty good views.
Short-eared owls are on the amber list, so they're not massively endangered yet, European-wise?
Yeah, they're a bit of an enigma, really. They're quite a difficult species to understand. There's been some really revolutionary studies in the last few years. Some guys have been fitting satellite tags to shorties to see where they go. And there's one female, I probably haven't got the order of this right, but they tagged her in Scotland when she was breeding. She's on the nest. And then once she'd laid the eggs, she took off, and I think she either went to Ireland first or Scandinavia first. I think it was Scandinavia.
Left or right?
I can't remember. Anyway, she abandoned this nest, took off to Scandinavia, set up with another male there, had another clutch of eggs there, and then a few months later zoomed over to Ireland, and then zoomed back to Scotland, all in the space of one breeding season, which is just bizarre. I mean, how do you explain that?
So basically had a man in every port.
Kind of, yeah.
What would happen to the eggs when they hatched then?
I don't know. I can't remember what happened. I don't know if the male would have taken over or if the whole nest was just banned. I can't remember. I was just fascinated by her decision to move so far once she just laid these eggs. It didn't make any evolutionary sense to me. It's an unusual species. It is pretty threatened on quite a few grouse moors. It's a species that gamekeepers tend to target.
Because it eats grouse?
or as byproduct of trying to kill the things that do eat grouse?
Yeah, it can eat grouse, but it can also disrupt a grouse shoot, which is probably more the issue there. So
a bird with a meter wingspan can disrupt 100 guys with guns.
Yeah, well, not disrupt them.
Naughty owls.
Disrupt the people who are driving the grouse. The whole line of beaters will walk across the moor, waving flags and blowing whistles to try and push the grouse towards the butts where the guys are standing with the guns. Mm-hmm. And if a bird of prey happens to fly over the moor at that point, it'll spook the grouse and they won't conform. They won't fly towards the butts. They'll just scatter everywhere, and so the whole drive is ruined. So you've got people standing in the grouse butt who might have paid, you know, up to 30 grand to stand there, depending on how prestigious the grouse moor is considered. So they're not going to be too pleased when they've not had a chance to shoot a whole load of red grouse because it's been disturbed by an owl or a hen harrier or a red kite or whatever else happens to be flying over.
I was going to leave driven grouse shoots till the very end of this.
That's fine.
Yeah. I am going to ask you more about short-eared owls. Is this the population here? We're in the Peak District at the moment. Is this a resident population, or is it one of the migratory birds that comes down from Scandinavia during the winter months? We're right on the cusp of winter now, so I presume it's the former.
I don't know. I don't know where they come from. They're here. They tend to...
Ground nest?
Yeah, they're all ground nesting. They tend to disappear. Although, you know, it could be that you just happen to come up on a day when they're on a different part of the moor. So they could, in fact, be here year round. Mm-hmm. But generally, you get decent sightings up until about October. And then you might get sightings after that, but then you come back in March, April time, see if they've come back.
Okay. So I know where it started, but I know that you left school at 16. Mm-hmm. And from what you've said on record before, it's not because you had a particular affinity to wildlife. Is that really true?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Didn't have any interest in it at all. Didn't know anything about it.
Didn't go walking in the countryside with parents? Didn't sort of have friends who made dens up trees?
I played out quite a lot. We were outside all the time, but it tended to be on a bike, generally trying to ride a bike down rivers.
Some people like gorge walking, other people prefer gorge cycling.
That was our thing. There used to be a park a couple of miles away from the house. And I was a bit of a tomboy, just hanging out with a couple of guys, but there's my best friend at the time was a guy called Tom, and we used to take our bikes down into the park, and there's this small river that ran through the park, and we'd get in at one end and try and ride the whole length of it without getting our feet wet, which we never managed to do. And then I'd come home and my mum would go mental because I'd come in with soaking wet feet, and I'd never understood why she was so angry about it, because it was just, you know, so what, they'll dry again.
That's not a million miles away from traversing the lakes of Madagascar in a canoe.
No, it isn't, but it was, we weren't looking at wildlife. We were challenging ourselves, can we get to the end of the river without getting our feet wet? And no, we can't.
Are you an adventurer and thrill seeker?
I probably was more so than I am now. I've kind of grown out of it quite a lot. But I do like adventure.
Is there much adventure to be found in the British Isles? Or are we too tame? Has the wild been exorcised from our country?
Well, it depends what kind of adventure you want, I guess. If you're into wild swimming, I've just got into swimming actually the last few months. And that's adventurous. I really enjoy that. So yeah, there's a sense of adventure. You can have adventures in that way. In terms of looking for wildlife, is it adventurous? Probably not. It's pretty tame.
What do they say? Try everything. So try something every day that scares you. They also say try everything once except for incest and folk dancing.
Who says that?
Them. You know those guys.
Well, okay. I don't know about that. But if you compare the fieldwork that I was doing in Madagascar, for example, mm-hmm. So I would be there. It's a remote country anyway. But mm-hmm. The place where I was working, I was camping, is a really really remote part of the country, the west part of the country, that takes like a day and a half to get there from the capital. And we were camping by these three massive lakes that held about eight or nine pairs of this species called the Madagascar fish eagle, critically endangered, doesn't live anywhere else other than Madagascar. But these three lakes was a real nucleus for them. So these birds had been studied for a long time by people at the Peregrine Fund, and I went over to do some more studies on them because they had this weird breeding behaviour, polyandrous. So you'd have a female with at least two males at a nest.
Same nest?
Yeah.
That's like some monkeys. Like a lot of monkeys end up like having multiple male partners.
Like some humans too.
Like some humans too.
But it is, I mean, it's fairly unusual, but it's not unheard of. It's, sure. It's quite common in the bird world, actually. But we wanted to know what was going on there. So these birds had been colour ringed, and my job was to canoe out from this camp every morning at 6 a.m, go and park myself in front of one of these nests and just sit and take notes, watch these eagles, see who's doing what, who's incubating, who's bringing in food, who's bringing in sticks, who's fighting, who's copulating, everything. Just sit and record everything at 10-minute intervals for the entire day and then canoe back to camp, sleep, get up, go and do the same thing the next day.
Is that fun?
Yeah, it was massively fun. But the point that I'm trying to get to is in terms of do something dangerous, living in this lake are massive Nile crocodiles, which I didn't know about until I got there. No one had bothered to tell me about them. So I started seeing them when I was canoeing out across the lake in the morning. You just see the top of their snout. You try and judge how big they are. And I talked to some of the local guys that we were working with, and you know, say, what's the deal with the crocodiles? And oh no problem. And these guys would all bathe in the lake at night. And I thought, I'm not sure about that. And then one day I was walking to the next village to get some supplies, and the Malagasy, when people die there, they bury them in these tombs and they paint pictures on the walls pictures from the person's life. And I was walking through the village and noticed one of these tombs. There's a guy on there who's just standing like this with his arms outstretched, and there's a crocodile with its jaw around the guy's middle. So you kind of think, okay, there's someone who died by crocodile. Mm. So I got pretty nervy about that. And then I came home after the first season and looked up everything I could find on crocodiles, because when I was there, we didn't have internet access or anything. Sure. I couldn't find out anything about them. I watched some National Geographic programme. I shouldn't have done it, but I did. These crocodiles nudging people in canoes and upending them from their canoes. So the next season, when I went out, I was absolutely paranoid about the crocodiles.
But you went back.
But yeah, because I had to. I was invested by then, but that's dangerous to me. And getting out, sitting in front of the nest, you couldn't just lose yourself in this nest. You had to constantly keep looking behind you to make sure there's a crocodile not crawling up the bank behind you to grab you. So, you know, and things like washing and doing your laundry. We did our laundry in the lake. I would get a bucket of water, fill it at arm's length on the edge of the lake, and move about 30 feet back from the shoreline, because I didn't want to be crouching at the side of the lake and be snapped up by a croc. So yeah, that kind of that's wild.
Mm-hmm. And you're a walk from civilization. It's not like there's popped a hospital, I've lost a leg to a croc. It's, can someone send a chopper across the...
No. So I had a really bad eye infection 1 year. I was like, it swelled up like a cricket ball. Didn't know what the hell was going on. Had to get out, and we had a radio, some archaic radio thing with the head office back in Tanna in the capital. So I managed to send a message through, say, I need to get out of here. And they said, well, it's going to take 4 days before we can get the vehicle over to you. I said, well, okay, then you need to send it, and then it'll be another 2 days back. So it would probably be a week before I could get any help. But luckily, in the next village along, there was a project, the Doral Wildlife Conservation Trust had a project, and they just happened to have some guys in town with a vehicle, and I went to see them and said, look, I need to go and get my eye looked at. And they said, well, no problem, we'll take you. So yeah, I was lucky that I could
nip out,
get out, yeah, but generally speaking, no, you're kind of on your own.
Let's rewind a bit before Madagascar. As I understand it, your two first jobs were, you did a couple of years at the Battersea Dogs Home, but then 7 years working for the Heathrow Animal Reception Centre.
Yeah.
What's that like? What kind of creatures come in, from whom and why?
Oh, Christ. Well, you name it, it'll come through. It was a really, really interesting job, actually. So part of it is domestic pets, you know, people transporting the pet dogs and cats around the world. And so part of the job was, if they were transiting, we'd see quite a lot of people going through to the States. So we'd get the pets off the plane, release them into these
containment areas, let them have a wee,
clean out the boxes, give them
some food. Let them come out and go, ah, what's just happened? Yeah. Oh God, yeah. Why would she do that to me? Ah!
It's really funny because some of them were chilled as anything, you know, they couldn't give them monkeys about what was going on. But others obviously were terrified. There's one cat that came through, and on top of the box, the owner had written instructions for us. A lot of people did that, understandably. But this woman had taped a photograph of her son in like a silver frame on top of the thing and said, Heathrow staff, please read this letter before you let the cat out. So we opened it, and it's this long letter saying that this cat will only eat if there's a photograph of her son next to the food bowl. So we thought we'd test it.
Did it work?
So we didn't put the photograph up. We just put the food bowl down, and yeah, it ate. It ate just fine.
But you did a scientific experiment to see what happened, even at a point before you'd consider going into conservation and science in general.
Well, I guess so. Well, yeah, I'm not sure how scientific it was. But
I'd say that's the start of a good. You got your test subject and. So what other things? Are we talking like endangered? Are you?
Yeah.
Because obviously people will be smuggling stuff, which is the stuff you won't see. Technically,
we did see a lot of it. So yeah, there was the domestic pet side, and then the other big side of it was the wildlife trade. So you'd get some legitimate things, the species coming through on zoo exchanges and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they've got the right paperwork, they're in the right size boxes.
Edinburgh needs a new polar bear, through it comes.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And then there's a whole load of dealership that goes on, and this is what really got to me in the end. This is why I left in the end. I just couldn't cope with it. But when I first got there, I was too young to think about that sort of thing. I was just excited to see all these different species, and particularly wild birds coming through. So you'd have dealers who would collect wild birds from Tanzania. That was a big port coming out of Dar es Salaam, and they'd ship them in these containers, selling them to people, to pet shop owners in the States. So they'd come through Heathrow, and they'd be like maybe an 8-9 hour stopover. So we would have to get those birds off the plane over to our place, identify everything just by shining torches through the grates and trying to make sure they haven't got anything in there that they shouldn't have. Check the ID against the paperwork that they've got, feed and water them, remove any that have died, check the boxes are all up to standard, you know, they've got the right number of perches, there's enough height in there, and all this kind of stuff.
Like, they're not anaesthetized, are they?
Oh, God, no, yeah. No.
Are they hooded? Like, what's
no,
going? They're just birds
no,
in boxes?
They're just these quite low boxes, I don't know. How high do you think that is?
Foot and a half?
Yeah. Covered in wood, and there'd be a little kind of ventilation thing at the front, and they'd put maybe 100 finches in there. So these finches are just going mental, just swarming around trying to get out, and there'd be hundreds of boxes of them in a shipment. From our perspective, what we were interested in was the welfare of the birds. You know, are they fit enough to travel? Are the boxes the correct size and enough ventilation? And are the species listed on the paperwork, what's in the box?
Sure.
That's what we were doing.
How often was it different?
Quite often. Huh. And also when people were importing them as well. There were a few notorious bird dealers. Some bird dealers were really good, and you know, no problem with their consignments. But there are a couple of dealers, every single consignment they had in, they'd be trying to get something in that they shouldn't have.
So what point during your time at Heathrow did you consider volunteering for what was the BTCV, what is now the Conservation Volunteers?
I did that fairly early on, actually, because...
And who told you about it?
It was a friend of a friend. So a friend who I was working with at Heathrow had a friend who was actually working for BTCV.
For those that don't know, could you quickly tell us what the BTCV is?
It was British Trust for Conservation Volunteers. I think they've got a new
it's
name
just
now.
The Conservation Volunteers.
Oh, right, OK. Capital Taking
T,
the British capital, out.
Yeah. To take the British out, remove the Union Jack off the front of it. Not that we're ashamed of our identity anymore.
So, I can't talk about what it is now, but then it was a national charity, and they'd have regional offices, and they'd employ a field officer in each of those places, and that field officer, their job was to get volunteers to come out and do conservation projects in the county. Mm-hmm. So things like footpath repair, rhododendron bashing, tree planting, bridge repair, any kind of practical stuff. So she was doing that, and because of the job at Heathrow, Heathrow is open 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So we used to do shift work, and quite often, if we were on a night shift, because they stopped the planes coming in after 1 o'clock in the morning, you could usually sleep. So you're getting paid quite well to sleep at the airport just in case something goes off and you need to be there.
Sure.
But generally you're asleep. So if you're on the night shift pattern, you tend to work three nights on and then have a week off.
Sure.
So I had a lot of time.
I want something to do.
Yeah, a lot of time on my hands. And quite often we'd have some excitement where a dog had been so frantic in the hold, it chewed its way out of its box. So when the baggage handlers opened the door to start unloading, quite often there'd be a dog there.
Oh, God.
Let me out, let me out. So they have to shut the door, obviously, because of the threat of rabies and all that kind of stuff. So we would get called. We would go over armed with tins of dog food and nets and things, and climb into the hole and try and coax this dog to come out. That happened a lot, actually, and with cats.
So through doing the BTCV, long story short, you started looking at sparrowhawks in Winter Great Park.
Yeah, by accident, complete accident. So we were out doing, I think we were rhododendron bashing in Winter Great Park, and it's an area that I lived quite close to the park, and I used to spend a lot of time walking my dog there. Mm-hmm. Anyway. So I thought I knew the park quite well. And we were there doing some roadie bashing, and we were having a lunch break. And the person who'd organised the day had organised for this guy to come and talk to us at lunchtime while we were sitting around. So this guy called Ted Green shuffled up in what looked like a dirty old Mack.
Probably was a dirty
old Mack.
Was.
And he looked like he'd been living outdoors for about 20 years. But he just had this charisma about him. And he just started talking. Old trees were his thing. He started talking about old trees in Windsor Great Park.
But there's great oaks in Windsor.
Yeah.
Brilliant ones.
Yeah. But also, he was a birder. And he put his hand in his pocket. I'll never forget it. He put his hand in his pocket and brought out this clump of feathers and started picking them off and saying, look, here's a barn owl feather. His tawny owl feather, his buzzard feather, his sparrowhawk feather. And I found all these on my way from the car to visit you all today. Mm-hmm. And I believed him like an idiot. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, you know. First of all, I was amazed that he could tell what species it was just from a feather. But also, this word sparrowhawk, I was like, what the hell's a sparrowhawk?
Had you come across many raptors?
No.
At Heathrow? None?
No, not really. By this stage, this was before the red kite reintroduction.
Okay.
And because those birds came through, and I was quite into them by the time those birds came through. But
that's cool to have been there, sort of on the ground watching these new animals come in.
Yeah, that was really cool. Yeah. Although when they came in, we thought they were all dead, because I now know red kites play dead in the nest. If they're frightened,
sure,
the chicks will just stock still. So these chicks had come in these, they were essentially dog crates, and they were all just lying there in the bottom like this, and we thought, they're dead. we called for the guy from Natural England now, I can't uh-huh. remember what they were calling themselves, English Nature,
sure.
Guy called Ian Evans, who was running the programme, who was just coming through the airport. Get over here quick, I think the kites are dead. He came racing over, looked in the box, he said, oh no, they're fine. This is what they do.
Did you know you were part of a major reintroduction programme initiative at that point? Or was it just interesting birds coming through? Dead ones?
Well, they had all the...
Nice
the,
stickers. They didn't have a picture of someone's son stuck to the outside saying, these red kites will only feed if you put down this young man.
They had... British Airways were big on the promo thing.
Sure.
Naturally, and quite rightly, you know, JNCC were involved, and they had these huge, huge panels on the side of the box. I still remember the bright green red kite reintroduction programme. But I didn't really comprehend what that meant. It didn't really
hit home.
No.
So sparrowhawks in Woods of Great Park.
Yeah, so he starts talking about these sparrowhawks. I'm like, what are you talking about, sparrow? How come I've been walking around Windsor Great Park for all this time and I've never heard of them, never don't know what he's talking about? He's like, oh, come out with us, come out and see. So I went out for a few weekends with them. It turned into quite a few years, actually. Mm-hmm. They would go out every weekend and just trudge through the trees looking for signs of these sparrowhawks. And most of the time, they wouldn't see the sparrowhawk, but they'd see the signs of the sparrowhawk. Mm-hmm. So the white splash or the plucked kill on a mound. And,
sure.
And I was just fascinated by all of that. And then one day, there was a sparrowhawk in the tree above us doing a... it was shouting its head off. I didn't know what it was. Luckily, Ted Green was standing next to me and was kind of saying, that's the female, she's food calling. And the male came in, did a food pass on the branch pretty much right above our heads. And the male cleared off and the female cleared off with her prey. And I was like, oh my God. I just couldn't believe what we'd seen.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get it out of my head. And I think what really did it was that this is all going on in a public park that I thought I knew quite well. And really didn't have a clue, so I wanted to know more.
Okay, so from there, and I'm please excuse me jumping through your career, but you from that point you got invited to go and study kestrels in Mauritius, then up to the Hawk Mountain Sanctuary in the Appalachians to study U.S. kestrels, and then down to Veracruz in Mexico to look at the hawk migration. And through all this, you're still technically an amateur. You're not officially qualified.
No, complete amateur. Just very enthusiastic. Knew a little bit, but not very much at all. But was just completely enamoured with the opportunity to watch these birds.
Do you feel like you needed to be qualified? Not in terms of getting access to future opportunities, but do you think by that on-the-ground experience that you had received as much as you were ever really going to need in terms of field research?
Well, I got quite a long way without the need for qualification, mm-hmm. but I didn't feel that I needed it at all. But then, at that stage anyway, but then later on, I was doing some work, worked on a project in Israel, again on raptor migration, and I was really unhappy with the way that project was run, or the way that some of the data were being collected. And I knew that if I called it, I did call it out actually, because that's kind of
who you are.
But you know, I didn't say, you know, this is crap. I said, you know, I don't understand why we're doing this when
they're doing this in Veracruz.
This might work a bit better, or we're not accounting for this very well. But I wasn't listened to, and I kind of knew then that probably one of the reasons that I wasn't listened to was because I wasn't seen as having any academic credibility.
Do you think there was a gender bias as well?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't really ever feel like that's been held against me at all.
But that's because you're a tomboy that goes down rivers on bicycles. And everyone's terrified of what you might suggest you might do next.
I don't know. But I spent a lot of time in the early part of my career in the States. And I guess it is quite a male-dominated field. But in the States, there are also quite a lot of women working in the field of raptor research as well. Uh-huh. And I think that probably helped a lot. But to me, it was never an issue.
Sure. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Whilst we're on it, tell me a little bit about the Mexican hawk migration, because I think I heard the number 4.6 million hawks go through that part of Mexico every year in one season.
Every autumn.
Because that's insane.
Well, what's even more insane is that most of those birds are coming through in a three-week period. So the migration count there starts 15th of August and runs through to, I can't remember if it's November or December. No, it might be November. So fairly short county season. Uh-huh. And you've got all these birds funneling from North America, trying to get into South America. And because they're birds of prey, they're not really designed for flying over the water very mm-hmm. well. And they've got such long journeys that they try and save a lot of energy. And to do that, they'll funnel through geographic points where there is huge thermals, which the birds can circle up to get to the top of the thermal without having to flap.
Sure.
And then as soon as the thermal runs out, the bird will just glide.
Soar down the other side.
And just glide, slowly losing height until it gets to the next thermal and it'll go up again.
So quite slow as well, I guess, good for identifying and counting.
Yeah.
How many different species?
Oh,
roughly?
God. I can't remember. Maybe 20. Can't remember, but the three main species were broad-winged hawks, Swainson's hawks, and turkey vultures. And I think the entire population of Swainson's hawks came through, and most of the broad-winged hawk population, and then a couple of million turkey vultures as well. And they tend to come through in flocks, those three species. So huge, vast flocks, hundreds of thousands of birds.
You just don't think of raptors flocking together.
Oh, God, no. And then in between, you'd have single migrants, so birds like ospreys and peregrines and merlins kind of zipping through, swallowtail kites. So it used to be called, we used to call it the River of Raptors, because you could look out, the birds would all roost down in the foothills, quite 30, 40 miles away. Mm-hmm. And we'd get there early in the morning to start counting at 6. And you can see them rising. They're waiting for the thermals to come up. You see them rising, and they come up on the thermals, and they start soaring towards you. And you look out, and the whole sky in front of you is just black with these raptors kind of swarming towards you. And there's usually three counters trying to estimate how many are coming through. And we have to split the sky. So we used to stand on top of this hotel building, because it was the tallest building around. Mm-hmm. So I'd take this side of the sky and say, okay, I'll take it to the water tank from there. You take the middle bit, and then the guy over there will take that half. And we stand there with these counters on our fingers, mm-hmm. and you look at what's coming. You can't identify them at this point. You just know that they're raptors coming through. And you're trying to estimate whether you're going to be counting on these counters in variables of 1,000, 5,000, 10,000, or
wow.
what. And then sitting in between, in the middle of you, is someone who's scribing for you.
Uh-huh.
So you've got your binoculars up, you've got your telescope up, and your eyes are just glued onto the sky, and you're waiting for the birds, and you don't start counting them until they're almost level with you, so that you're not
it's
double
like a finish
counting.
Line that they're crossing. Yeah.
And then you just start clicking, and then if you're seeing a single migrant come through, you're calling out, you know, osprey, peregrine, merlin, swallowtail kite, and this puts scribes trying to keep track. And then you wait for that mass to go through, and there might be a bit of a lull, so then you'll go and download your counters, clear them all, and then start again, wait for the next lot to come. And this time you might be counting in multiples of 2,000, 4,000, until very late in the day when you're down to multiples of, you know, 100.
Sure.
There's 100 in that flock. But it's pure madness, absolute madness. And just, it can only ever be an estimation of what's going on.
Are there many bottlenecks like that around the world?
Yeah. So Veracruz was only discovered fairly recently, I think. I think in 94, 95. Before that, Eilat in Israel was the big one.
That's where you went to next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they have a million and a bit going through there.
Only a million.
there are quite a few others that have sprung up since then, but the Mexico one, these Mexican boys who were into birds had found it. I mean, they hadn't found it. It's been going on for years, but
it had reached the international community.
But
and
they paid attention to it, and they took their news of these birds to North America, to a place called Hawk Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hawk Mountain crew believed them, because Hawk Mountain people know about raptors and know what they do, and thought, yeah, this is completely feasible. The rest of the scientific community didn't believe them. I think probably because they were Mexican. Again, they didn't have the academic credibility.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. So there's all this, you know, is this true? Is this true? And in the end, Hawk Mountain, which is where I was at the time, and another group called Hawkwatch International, who specialise in raptor migration camps, decided to send teams of counters down to Veracruz to count alongside the Mexican guys to try and verify the figures. So I was lucky enough to get invited onto that trip. So there was us, mostly Americans, and me on one hotel roof, and then on another hotel roof just across the way were the Mexicans, and we're all just counting what we could see. And yeah, surprise, surprise. The Mexicans knew exactly what they were talking about, and we got 4.6 million birds coming through. That's it. It's just bonkers.
It's bonkers.
Yeah.
By this point in your career, this is the question: did you have a favourite bird?
I was quite taken with kestrels, actually.
I was going to ask, because in Mauritius it was kestrels. Yeah. Hawk Mountain, you were looking at American kestrels.
Yeah, I was really taken with kestrels.
I think you like banded kestrels, I read.
Yeah. So
why kestrels? I mean, I love kestrels.
Well, because that's what was on Mauritius.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, I went to Mauritius, so I took a sabbatical from Heathrow, because I really got to the point where I had started to think about what was going on and what I was seeing, and wasn't really comfortable with it at all. Needed some time out, took a sabbatical, went to Mauritius, met a guy called Carl Jones, who is just a phenomenal guy, a Welsh guy, absolutely nuts, but a conservation guru. He'd gone to Mauritius quite a few years before to close down a project. There was a Mauritius kestrel species that only lived on Mauritius, and it was going extinct. I think there were four birds left. Lots of ornithologists had tried to save it. They couldn't, and they'd sent Carl out to say, okay, we need to close this project down. And Carl had got out there and thought, I'm not closing this project down. I'm going to give it a go, see if I can save this bird. So he did. He refused to answer the phone to anybody. Took all these kestrels that were left into captivity, started breeding them, double clutching them, and releasing the birds. At the same time, doing quite a lot of predator control.
That would take the eggs.
Yeah, the invasive species like rats, mongoose, cats, all these species that were not native to that island.
Who was funding it?
Initially, it was a group called ICBP, which I think is the precursor to BirdLife International.
Okay.
Doral Wildlife Trust, Jerry Doral was involved, and also the Peregrine Fund in the States. So, yeah, he managed to pretty much save the Mauritius kestrel. And then he started working on other bird species that were things like the pink pigeon and the echo parakeet, doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went to Mauritius, I got to work with this kestrel. And so I was just absolutely charmed by a really, really cool species, overwhelmed with what he had done and what he was continuing to do. So, yeah, I kind of got into kestrels. And then I went to Hawk Mountain, and they just happened to be doing a study on American kestrels, and they said, oh, look, you've worked on the Mauritius kestrel, why don't you help us out on this American kestrel? And so I got into that. So that was where the kestrel thing came from. And then I started reading, I was always interested in Madagascar for a long time, really wanted to go there, and I knew that they had a species there called the banded kestrel that looked weird in the guidebooks. It didn't look like a kestrel, and nobody knew anything about it.
Sure.
And I thought, oh, that might be my opportunity to get there.
So at this point, you then had to get qualified. So you did your PG dip? Not PG dip.
No, I did a master's.
Master's and then your PhD.
Yeah.
But you were asked to focus on the Madagascan fish eagle by the Peregrine Fund.
Yeah. They just out of the blue, I'd been hassling this guy, a guy called Rick Watson, who ran the Madagascar project. I'd been hassling him for a few years. Can I go to Madagascar and work on some of your projects? And he's like, no.
Fair enough.
So I go away and try again next year. He'd be like, no. And then one year, I ran into him at a conference, and he said, oh, you know, what are you doing? I said, I just finished up in Mexico, going home, don't really know what I'm going to do. And he's like, do you still want to go to Madagascar? I'm like, yeah. And he said, we've got a project on this fish eagle, and it's a bit complicated, this breeding system's a bit weird, and we want someone to look at it. Do you want to have a go? And I said, yeah. But I don't know anything about eagles at all. He's like, it doesn't matter, you'll learn. But he said, you can only go if you're going as a student, because what he didn't want to
happen. Was that because of finance or because of visas? Or?
No, it's because he knows that there are lots of people who work around the world on conservation projects, doing all the cool field work, and then never write it up.
Sure, okay.
But if you're a student, you're invested in it,
yeah,
you have to.
Or at least it's in your best interest to use that experience to get something on paper.
Yeah, so he's pretty smart, really. So that's why I went to do a master's, to kind of fulfil that obligation.
There's a wonderful episode about your time with the Madagascar fish eagle referenced in your book over here, the Eagle Watchers, where you talk about a one-legged fish eagle called Cutoff, which you shouldn't have named, but you did.
Well, there's a thing, you see. Who says you shouldn't name them?
Should we name our subjects in scientific research?
See, this is where Carl Jones's influence comes in. Up until that point, until I'd really worked with him, I'd heard all this stuff. You shouldn't name animals and blah blah. Carl Jones had the complete opposite view, and he said you have to get to know these species as individuals, because that's the only way that you'll conserve them. And I guess for him, on his project, that is true, because he was working with so few birds left.
Committed you are to saving them, the more likely you are to save them.
Yeah, but you need to understand them as individuals, because they don't all operate in the same way. And I've taken that with me. I'm a firm believer
in naming.
And getting to know some of these species as individuals.
Okay, here's a question. Well, your time when you were looking at the Madagascan fish eagle, did you actually get to see the banded kestrel?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wrote a paper on it.
Oh, great. Awesome. Was that for your PhD or just on the side of?
No, just on the side.
Something to do, you know.
Well, it was really funny, because we camped in the wood, in these deciduous forests. It was a really, really cool place, right on the edge of a lake. And there'd be Sifaka lemurs living in the forest that would come. They'd come through the forest every morning at the same time foraging, and they'd come through our camp. And then at the same time, there was another bird coming through called what the hell's it called? I think it was called the hook-billed vanga or something. I can't even remember.
Sounds
so long
great.
Ago. That would come through. They got these great long hooked bills, and they would forage around the bark of the trees looking for insects and stuff. And a group of them, a flock of them, would come through camp straight after the Sifaka lemurs had come through. You'd be sitting there having your tea in the morning, watching all this going on. And then every morning, behind those birds, came the banded kestrel. And the banded kestrel would come on its own and sit and watch where these birds were foraging, I guess waiting for stuff to come out, insects to pop out. And then it'd come down and grab something to fly off every morning, same. It was fab.
Sounds brilliant.
So it was just it was just something that you couldn't help but notice, uh-huh. because you're camping there. There's nothing else to see. You have to take note of what's going on.
Better than television.
Yeah.
We need to move on to talking about your blog quickly, but you then spent some time in Cambodia and Mongolia, but ended up working in Scotland. Everything got a little bit less exciting from my perspective, at least. And you did various things, from monitoring wind farms and the damage they were having to local avian life, but also collecting DNA from golden eagles, ospreys and stuff like that from within that job. At what point does monitoring birds in Scotland lead to you wanting to set up a blog that is focused upon human-led raptor persecution?
Just hearing time and time again from raptor workers, people in the Scottish Raptor Study Group who I was working with as part of that job, who would constantly talk about the illegal killing of birds on certain estates, and the same estate names kept coming up over and over and over again, and I couldn't quite comprehend, actually, because I'd worked in the raptor world for quite a long time by that point, and I had no clue that this was going on in my own country. Mm-hmm. You know, I was completely oblivious to it, and that didn't sit well with me at all. Well, if I don't know about it, other people probably don't know about it either. So that was the decision, really, to start writing the blog, was to start raising awareness about it. Because from what I could see, the RSPB were looking at it, but this was before really social media got going. Mm-hmm. And so they would write annual reports, but they'd be hard copy reports, and you could only get them if you knew that they existed, and wrote to the lodge to get them. So the information just wasn't getting out there to
Joe Public.
Yeah.
Okay. And you think that's essential? You think you need to get the populace to care?
Yeah.
Not just legislating accordingly to try and prevent it, or hiring enough wildlife crime officers who can be on the ground to prevent it first?
No, I think...
It has to be a public uprising.
I think so, yeah. The politicians will only act if they think that the public care about something enough, mm-hmm. I think. Otherwise, you know, why would they bother? So unless you've got enough people talking to their MPs, MSPs, and saying, look, I care about this, what are you going to do about it? Nothing will happen.
So, to my understanding, the Labour Party has, I think, about 400,000 members, Conservative Party around 175,000 members, something like that. RSPB's got like 1.2 million members. At what point does an organisation like that realise they can mobilise their people to stand up? Because I imagine pretty much every single person who's a member of the RSPB wants raptors protected, wouldn't you say?
That's You're asking question. The wrong person. I'm not a member of the RSPB. They don't go far enough uh-huh. for me. I've got a huge respect for their investigations team. They do an incredible job. But from the outside looking in, the investigations team appears to be operating in an almost isolated way from the rest of the RSPB.
Interesting. Your blog post of yesterday actually used their most recent bird crime report.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting, that you, as an outsider, as a non-member of the RSPB, was actually using their information to try and hit home some key points.
Yeah, because they're the only organisation who put together those data. Uh-huh. That's their investigations team. You can't get that data anywhere else.
Sure. So in that recent report, in the last year, in that year, I think it was 2017, is that most recent?
No, when 2021.
2021. The worst counties were Norfolk having 13 incidents, Dorset having 12 incidents, and North Yorkshire having 10 incidents, whereas in the previous decade, North Yorkshire had been considerably worse than that.
Yeah.
Does that lead one to believe that things have got better?
Why? Because North Yorkshire were third down the list.
Yeah, they're heading down to relegation.
No, you can't look at it on such a short-term basis, and those incidents are only the ones that have been discovered or reported. We often say it's just the tip of the iceberg.
And are those counties in particular, are they famous grouse shooting counties.
Well, North Yorkshire is, yeah, for sure. Dorset isn't. They don't have grouse shooting.
So what's going on there then? Because there's been the crimes against ospreys recently down in...
White-tailed eagles.
White-tailed eagles as well, yeah.
They've got a lot of lowland shoots down there where people are shooting pheasants and partridge, red-legged partridge.
But it's always linked to hunting?
Not always, but predominantly it is. The vast majority of cases are linked to game bird shooting. But then there are the types of persecution. There's still a lot of peregrine theft, for example, going off the falconry trade. There's a massive case going on at the moment in Scotland on that. You get pigeon fanciers still putting out poisoned bait to kill off peregrines that they think are attacking their birds. You get the odd egg collector, nowhere near as many as there used to be, but there's still a few out there. So there are other types of rapt persecution as well, but it tends to be concentrated on some estates, not all estates, but some estates that are used for game bird shooting.
If you could do anything to try and make the problem disappear or dissipate, what would you do? Kill all human beings.
No.
Ban sport hunting.
I'd ban driven grouse shooting in a heartbeat. Uh-huh. Yeah, and that would put a stop to it on driven grouse moors, for sure, but it wouldn't stop it in the lowlands. So there's an argument for banning pheasant and red-legged partridge shooting as well, just on the basis of the amount of persecution that goes on.
Am I right in saying that 20% of Scotland is used for grouse shooting?
Well,
is that right? You wrote a report for Revive.
It's a contentious issue. It depends on whose figures you look at. There's a huge amount of variance. So generally, people now say anywhere between 8 and 18% of
land.
It's nice and broad. But it depends how you measure it, because if you're just measuring the actual heather moorland, you're excluding all the parts around the edge of the moorland. They're also used as part of the management, but aren't actually heather. You know, there could be a block of conifer trees or something else. So it is difficult to measure, but yeah, it's a lot. It's a big area.
5 years ago, 6 years ago, you and Chris Packham and Mark Avery set up Wild Justice. What made you want to do that in particular? And what is Wild Justice?
What made us want to do something? We didn't know that we wanted to do that. What got us riled? We were mates anyway by that time.
The Kestrel Appreciation Society.
Yeah, working on bits and pieces together, but nothing formally really. But what really, really got to us, there was a series of cases in Scotland, rapt persecution cases, that were due in court. I think there were five in a row within a period of about 6 weeks. One after the other, these cases were dropped in court, usually by the Crown Office, which is the Scottish equivalent of CPS. And one of them in particular was a video footage that the RSPB had caught, the investigations team again doing their stuff. They'd got video footage of a guy on an estate in Scotland who's dressed as a gamekeeper, so you assume he's a gamekeeper. The camera was focused on the hen harrier nest, or just it was just off it actually, because they were monitoring the nest. And you see this bird rise from the nest. You can't see the gamekeeper at this point, he's off camera, but you see the bird rise from the nest, and as it flies out of shot, there's a big puff of feathers. Feathers just come floating all over the place. So you think, okay, the bird's been shot. And then a few seconds later, into the shot walks this guy dressed as a gamekeeper with a shotgun, who walks right across the camera, out of view, and then comes back a few seconds later. He's carrying a dead hen harrier, and he's stopping on his way back to pick up some of the feathers that have been that come from the carcass, and then he walks out of view again. So pretty obvious what's happened. So the RSPB reported it to the police. Police reported it to the Crown. It went through, I think, about 2 years worth of pre-trial hearings in court, loads of hearings, and we all thought it was going to go through to trial. And then the day before the trial, the case was dropped, and the Crown Office said that the RSPB's video evidence was inadmissible because they didn't have the landowner's permission to be filming there.
That's insane.
It is insane. But it happened before, wasn't the first time. And that case, on the back of several others that had also been dropped, we were furious, absolutely furious with the way things were going. And we wanted to do something about it. And we thought about taking private prosecutions. We thought, if the Crown aren't going to do this, would we be able to do it? So we didn't know anything about taking legal action at that point. So Mark had some friends in London who were lawyers who he'd worked with on a case already, on the Henaria case. And he said, look, let's go and get some advice. So we had a meeting in London, the room full of lawyers who were environmental lawyers and were there to give us some advice. And we went to see them and said, look, this is what's going on. This is what can we do about this? And they said to us, before you do anything, you to get any access into the court, you really need to be an entity, a legal entity. So, you know, you set up a company and it'll be far easier for you to get court cases that way. And we were like, oh, really? Okay, then. We'll do that. So, yeah, that's how it happened. We had a meeting. We decided in the pub in the afternoon that, yes, we were definitely going to do it. It took us a couple of weeks to come up with the name. It was Mark's wife came up with the name, actually. And we just formalised it, got a logo, got a website, and got on with it, really.
And most of the time you're using the power of judicial review.
Yes.
So holding people account for doing what laws say they should already be doing. Am I right in saying that that's basically your methodology?
Yes, it has been. Because
you're highlighting where governmental bodies are failing and what they should have already been up to.
Yeah, or pointing out that what they're doing is unlawful.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it's pretty straightforward, I think.
Yeah, you would hope so. We live in a world, especially over the last 5 years, where the government has been very clearly demonstrating that they're not actually doing what they should have been doing quite a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so recently you've made it clear to Ofwat that they should have been responsible for the environmental impact of their runoff, which they were ignoring. There's been certain success with, I think, the Northern Irish badger cull.
Oh no, we're still waiting for the result on that. Even though the court case was, I think, November last year, December, we haven't had a decision yet. But we did hear from the court last week that they're expecting to give us a decision soon.
So
we might get an answer within a year, who knows? But yeah, that's Northern Ireland for you. So.
Do they have a government at the moment?
I don't think they do.
No. Do we have a government at the moment? Don't answer that. Yeah, and then there's the general licences successes about shooting in general and the releases of game birds near sites of special scientific interest.
Yeah. We've done quite a lot on general licences, and I think there's probably still a fair bit that we could do. But yeah, they were in such a mess.
This is the license to release game birds or to shoot game birds? What, for those who don't know what a general license is, what is a general license?
Well, there are lots of different general licenses, but
hence the generality.
Yeah, and basically it means it's light touch regulation, really. The general license rules will be published on the government website, so you don't actually, if you want to shoot a certain species, you don't have to apply for a license. You're covered by the general license. Mm-hmm. If you've read what the government says on the website. But well, our big concern really around general licenses is the annual release of millions of non-native game birds.
About 60 million, isn't it?
About 60 million. Yeah, about 50 million pheasants and about 10 million red-legged partridge every year.
That's kind of crazy when there are about, am I right in saying, 40 breeding pairs of hen harriers, and yet we're putting 60 million game birds into the population.
And there's virtually, or there hasn't been virtually any regulation over that. You can, if you own some land or you've got permission from the landowner, you can release as many of those birds as you like. You don't have to tell anybody, and you can then shoot as many of them as you like, and you don't have to tell anybody, which is fairly bonkers, mm-hmm. I think. So that was the starting point for us. There are all sorts of nuances within that about general licenses. You get general licenses for shooting certain species that are considered, you know, so-called pest species, species like crows. And our main argument against general licenses originally was that the government hadn't asked people to use lethal control as the last resort. You mm-hmm. know, which is how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to try every
other method first.
Yeah.
And am I right in saying the Welsh government have just had a big a request for people to comment upon what they think should change next?
Well, they've done a consultation, public uh-huh. consultation. So they've followed on. We lost a legal challenge against NRW a couple of years ago about game bird releases, but they've seen what's happened in England and what DEFRA have been forced to do. So now they're kind of doing it off their own back, which is great. And they've put a proposal together to suggest that if you're releasing pheasants or red-legged partridges further than 500 metres from a protected site, you should probably only be able to do that under a general licence. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, there isn't even a general licence for that.
Just do it whatever.
Just do it whatever. And there's no way for NRW to monitor what's going on. But also, they're suggesting that if you want to release pheasants or partridges on a protected area or within 500 metres of a boundary, that should be under an individual licence. And we're kind of supportive of it, although we don't think the general licence will work. We think it should be an individual licence for everything if you want to release non-native birds. But they had a massive response from the game bird shooting industry, who obviously are all objecting to any kind of regulation
Funny
whatsoever.
That.
So the licensing that was proposed, the minister's still got to make a decision, should make a decision this autumn, I think. But the licence won't be in place in time for next
year. Shooting season.
But if the minister approves it, then it'll be in place for 2024.
Well, I've had a wonderful time looking for short-eared owls.
I'm sorry we didn't see any short-eared owls.
This is radio. We can pretend that we saw hundreds of things. We saw the short-eared owl migration of September. 4.6 million of them flying over the Peak District.
It would have been cool to have seen some.
Such is the joy of nature that it doesn't always perform. Thank you very much, Ruth.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And that's that. An owlless but incredibly informative time spent in the Peaks. Thank you very much, Ruth. Now, as that interview was recorded about 3.5 months ago now, some things have changed. For the better, in fact. The Northern Irish Badger Cull court case mentioned 10 minutes back ruled in Ruth's, Wild Justice's and the Northern Irish badger population's favour. In October, the High Court judge ruled that the Department for Agriculture, Environment and Rural Affairs failed to fairly disclose enough information about their planned badger cull during the consultation period and that all plans were to be quashed. Hooray. So, if you would like to help Ruth further hold our governments to account, to uphold the laws that they have made, laws that they should be abiding by, laws that protect our environment, then heading along to Wild Justice's website and donating a few pennies would be a wonderful way to start. And if you don't believe me and Ruth when we say that wildlife crime is going on right now, then sadly, head to Ruth's Wrapped to Persecution blog, link on our website, to see just how naive you are. We will be back in 1 month's time with either an episode on birds' nests or one on reintroducing a very sexy wildcat to Britain. I'm not 100% sure which one yet, so if you have a preference, why not shout at me via Twitter, Instagram, Patreon, or through our website, treesacrowd.fm. But until then, thank you very much for listening and making it all the way to the end of what seems like an incredibly long outro. Bye-bye for now. Bye-bye.
Oh, the oak and the ivy, oh, the oak and the ivy, oh.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.